Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome back to Robots and Red Tape. As always, your host Nick Shutt here with my friend Sandeep Katharia today. Sandeep, how are you, sir?
Great.
Oh man, I'm so glad to hear it. Really excited to have you on. Today we're going to talk about the incredibly stimulating conversation or of topic of CMMC compliance and how that relates to government contracting companies, specifically within the technology space. Well, not just technology space, folks that are doing work within DoD overall. So Sandeep, for those of the folks that for folks that don't have the opportunity to know you yet, man, will you just tell everybody a little bit about, yourself, your background, and kind of how you got here?
So I love the podcast, by the way, big fan. So I am here for the red tape portion of the podcast. So I'm a government contracts attorney, done that my whole career. I got into cybersecurity sort of by accident, like 15, 17 years ago. I was working for a large telecom company, and the cyber and security folks brought me questions about what we call today cyber hygiene. And I worked with the company inside the company to kind of remediate those kinds of questions and issues. And that's how I first got the bug of cybersecurity. We weren't even calling it cybersecurity then. It was just called InfoSec. So I've done it ever since. And around the time I first got involved in cyber, unbeknownst to me, the Department of Defense was also starting to work on regulations. And again, this is like 2009, somewhere in that time frame. And around that time, up until that point, we were dealing mostly with voluntary requirements. That and like standards being dropped into contracts 100 at a time. So we didn't really have what you call sort of a unified regulatory approach. And we've been working towards that ever since. And that's why I'm here today to talk to you about it.
Oh, awesome, man. No, really appreciate it. Just so everybody knows, anything Sandeep says is not to be taken as legal advice. And if anything that he does say, has a sparks a question, you should definitely reach out to either him or to your attorney, whoever you're using, to make sure that make sure you're covered, because anytime you're dealing with law and legal issues, I always say call your attorney. That's the right, that's always the smart move. It might cost money up front, but it saves you money in the long run. Am I wrong, Sandeep?
The disclaimer, I'm glad you said that.
It's all good. And now you're at Ice Miller, correct?
Correct.
You got a mid-sized firm out of the Midwest, great GovCon practice here in the DC area, among other things, a lot of technology experts as well. So man, so how did DoD cybersecurity rules evolve into what is now CMMC?
And so my first exposure was around 09 when I went to sort of an industry day at the DoD held in some auditorium, and we were talking about what eventually became the DFARS 7012 clause, based on the numbering of the DFARS regulations. And it took a long time to get there. So it took we, not until October of 2016 did we have a final rule in the Defense Federal Acquisition Regulation supplement dealing with both cybersecurity standards as well as incident reporting, which became mandatory then. And in that rule that was first published and finalized in 2016, there was a deadline of December 31st, 2017, to implement 110 security requirements in another publication that was managed by the National Institute of Standards and Technology. They called it Special Publication 800-171. So you had basically a year and 4 months to get your house in order and comply with these 110 requirements. What we saw, though, happening into 2018, unless you were working for a big defense contractor like I was, everybody else was mostly struggling. So a lot of companies were not meeting all 110 controls. They were taking advantage of what you might consider to be kind of a loophole in the implementation, allowing for companies to have plans of action and milestones. And basically, the idea was as long as you have a plan to fix the problem, you're okay. You're still considered compliant under the DoD regulations. But that was taking too long. So 2019 comes around, and Katie Arrington, who was a Trump appointee as a highly qualified expert in DoD, came up with the idea of CMMC. So she wanted to make sure that companies were actually meeting all 110 controls. And I know that was 6.5 years ago. So it took a very long time to get to through the regulatory process. There was a lot of engagement with industry. I was involved in that to get the technical model and to get it right and to make sure that there's a plan forward on the policy side as well. And there's a lot of rulemaking. I'll skip all that. Just bottom line is, in October 2024, we saw a federal rule finalized that made CMMC, which is again called the Cybersecurity Maturity Model Certification Program, if I didn't say it earlier, made it a federal program. And then what we saw effective last week, November 10th, 2025, we now have a rule in the Defense Federal Acquisition Regulation Supplement and contracting clauses implementing CMMC. So we finally, basically, after 6.5 years, have a live program that will affect virtually every defense contractor.
Right. So every single defense contractor needs to be compliant with these 110 items within CMMC, correct? Or is that not the 110 still?
Yeah, so I mean, and so that's the rule now. It's going to be expand over time, but and you will have to, there's still some time. So there's considered something called a phased rollout. So not all of these requirements will hit all at once. I'm going to get into that a little bit later. But essentially, if you want to do business with the Department of War or Department of Defense, you need to meet these security requirements or have a acceptable alternative plan so that you're meeting the regulations.
Yeah, I mean that's also a big deal. I mean, have there been major like breaches or other issues that have like pushed this forward?
And the Department of Defense talked about it in the rulemaking, right? So just the nation state breaches against the United States and defense contractors have been pretty significant, cost billions and billions of dollars in lost intellectual property and technological superiority and so forth. So that's what's driving this, is just the need to make sure that all defense contractors handling what they call controlled and classified information, sensitive information on their internal information systems are meeting at least a basic standard.
I mean, that feels like it makes sense, and it feels like it shouldn't have taken so long. But this is the government, so you know, what do you expect? And I mean, and cyber attacks are continuing to accelerate. I don't know if you saw the news last week where Anthropic was attacked with the Chinese apparently attacked Anthropic and used AI agents to essentially automate the entire thing, which I find ironic. Yeah, I think that it's going to continue to expand, especially targeting companies that have access to classified information on their internal systems, right?
I mean, well, we're talking about a system that or a program that deals with controlled unclassified information. But yeah, absolutely right. The adversaries realize it's a lot cheaper to hack into our networks than to develop the technology themselves, right? So that's what we're dealing with as a country, and that's why we have these stricter cybersecurity regulations. And you're right, in terms of like keeping pace with the threats. We're still way behind, right? We're talking about regulations that were supposed to be in place, at the end of 2017, so almost 8 years ago, right? And we're just catching up now and forcing companies to make sure they're doing that. Well, the world has changed in the last 8 years. And so there's a new publication out of NIST, Rev 3, Data 171. It's currently on hold. Department of Defense has not required it yet, but it will. So basically, if you meet CMMC level 2, you're just keeping pace from where you should have been at the end of 2017.
Right.
So there's a lot more to do.
Yeah, I mean a whole lot more. And I actually 6 months ago did a whole episode with Josh Teal about the cost of IP theft on this in this country. And I mean you look at a lot of these platform designs overseas. They're whether it's a new jet or whatever, a lot of this is really based on technology that we've paid to develop here internally and stolen, and they've just stolen the designs, right? And then I mean I think like that's a huge problem for us as a country, because when we're spending lots and lots and lots and lots of money to develop and build out and push these scientific and technological boundaries forward, then these other countries are just like stealing the end product, right? And they don't have to bear that cost of the R&D costs. I mean, that to me is a huge national security problem, and something that really should be addressed and talked about more is how much that costs us and costs our nation.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right, and we're seeing a much greater push from the Department of War to promote innovation and new technologies and reaching out to Silicon Valley and startups. But again, it's very important to deliver uncompromised to protect that information the sensitive information on your information system, so the adversary doesn't get a sneak peek into what you're doing. So yeah, it's absolutely important. And historically, cybersecurity has been a cost center, right? So it's like, okay, you got to spend more money on tools, on people. But now it's becoming really a competitive advantage. So if you are leaning forward, if you have leaned forward on your cybersecurity program and can meet the Department of War's and Department of, I'll call it, I'll change it, War and Defense, I say it interchangeably. If you can meet the department's requirements, you have a leg up in getting business, because CMMC is going to be a requirement in, again, virtually all defense contracts. There'll be exception for COTS items, but essentially, if you're doing any kind of significant work for the Department of Defense as a prime or a subcontractor, you're going to need to meet this requirement. So if you can do it and your competitors can't, that gives you a leg up.
Yeah, absolutely. And what are some of the biggest misconceptions you've been seeing about, in industry, around CMMC now, still?
I think that the biggest challenge is that people may think it's somebody else's problem. So if you're in the legal department, you might think, "Oh, our IT people are great, so they've got it, right?" Or if you're the IT department, you might say, "Well, our managed services provider is great, so they've got it." And that may or may not be right, right? But the challenge is really it's a shared responsibility. So we all need to kind of understand the basic requirements. And there's an education process for lawyers as well as really, executives, anyone in a company, to understand what those requirements are, and not just to take somebody else's word for it. And that's what CMMC is trying to fix, right? Because for the longest time, we had a regime where it was self-attestation. So a company could just basically attest they're meeting the requirements and not really drill deep down and understand if they really were. And now we have a third-party regime. If I didn't explain this before, I should have. Basically, third party, you've got to go to a third party to assess your cybersecurity program. So an independent third party. And if you don't meet those requirements, you don't get certification, right? And so that's a very big difference, is there's a verification, validation, that you're meeting your requirements. And if you're not, then you're not going to be able to do business.
Yeah, absolutely. And how should these companies be, what should, enterprises be doing to prepare right now? And how does the preparation requirements for a small business versus a large business, how do those differ based on size?
So I think you're going to be doing some of the same kinds of things, right? You're going to identify what's a covered contractor information system, right? What are the systems I need to protect at this level, right? And then confirm you have a system security plan for those systems, for all of those systems, and a plan of action and milestones if you have deficiencies on those systems, right? Now, if you're a large, sophisticated company, you've been at this for a very long time. On your enterprise network, you should be in pretty good shape, right? But then you still may have other networks, other systems that have controlled and classified information being processed on them, and you need to understand that too, right? So that's an important factor for everyone, really, just understanding where the data is and what systems are covered, and then making sure you've got either you have already met those requirements or have a plan to meet them relatively quickly at this point, because we have a live regulation in the DFARS now. So you'll want to review your documentation, look at security gaps, figure out if you got a if there are issues that take a long time or cost a lot of money to fix, get working on those right away, right? Because we're running into a clock now where we're going to see CMMC requirements in contracts in 2026. That's guaranteed. Another really key point is making sure you are in line to get an assessment, because there's a big difference between, there's a lot more companies that are going to need assessments than there are companies that can do them, that are qualified to do them. So getting in line is another important factor.
How many
And then
companies qualified to do them? Do you know?
you've got to get approval by the Cyber AB. It's called the Cyber AB. So it's the accrediting organization, and they've accredited less than 100 organizations. To do cybersecurity assessments, and it's not easy to get accredited. So you've got to meet your own, you've got to on your own meet rigorous cybersecurity requirements just to become able to do assessments. There's a lot that goes into that. So that's a very, very important factor, is making sure you've got an assessor lined up, because the line's going to get really long.
I'm sure.
And then if you are a prime or a contractor of any kind really, you've got subcontractors, you've got to look at your supply chain, because if the requirement is to flow down and do some surveillance of your supply chain to make sure they are meeting these CMMC requirements. And if your suppliers can't meet the requirements, that's going to affect your ability to win awards at the prime level potentially.
Right. So you need to have the right team and really be looking into this and have this, really in your thoughts moving forward, no matter what you're doing, if you want to do. Now, does this apply to anybody outside of DoD, or is this just DoD, work?
So right now, this is a Department of Defense or Department of War program. At one point, the Department of Defense wanted to bring in DHS, Department of Homeland Security, to have some sort of reciprocity. Last I recall, DHS kind of went in their own direction. Now, I think what we might see, though, is if CMC is successful, that civilian agencies would pick up on it and you would see it kind of apply, government-wide. I think that's probably the intention, or it was at least at one point the intention of the Department of Defense, is to make it have one kind of standard across government, maybe even overseas. Like we could see other countries also adopt CMMC. I think Canada has definitely leaned forward on the NIST publication. So it has the potential to be sort of the standard internationally, which would be helpful as you scale CMMC if it becomes like basically basically an entry point for any kind of government contract. Then that helps the DoD and DO Department of War as they roll it out.
I feel like that makes too much sense for the government to do it. I'm not gonna lie to you. I feel like one standard is just too simple. And there are gonna be people that are gonna want their special toys, and their own special certifications. Based on my experience working with the government, and I'm sure you would agree with me.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the problem is everybody likes their own regulations, their own contracting clauses. I do think, though, it has the potential to kind of standardize things. And it was one of the Biden executive orders was about trying to standardize contracting clauses. And I don't think it didn't get anywhere. But, so the idea's been around for a very long time across administrations. Let's try to standardize. It's never actually worked, but maybe this time. We'll see.
Maybe. Well, we will see, man. I don't really know where all this is gonna go, and what are the really biggest gaps you're seeing right now within the space?
Oh, yeah, I think when you're thinking about like if you've got gaps, right, you're probably by definition underachieving, not meeting security controls. And the Department of Defense has published a list of the top five or top 10 security controls that are other than satisfied. That's the term they use. But I think it's also a risk if you're overachieving. If you've documented in your system security plan, your policies and procedures that you go way beyond a requirement, and then you get assessed on it. Maybe you're not going way beyond. I think that's another important thing to keep in mind is not to try to overachieve if you don't have to. I think that certainly there are a lot of issues people are struggling with in terms of how to meet all the controls, especially if you don't have the resources that you need. I think you got to basically take a look. And if you haven't looked at your security program in a while, because you become reliant on a third party or you just haven't had to do that, you're probably going to want to take a realistic assessment, maybe do a mock assessment of CMMC so that you can kind of figure out what you need to do next. That's a good step is to do that mock assessment. And there are, companies that help you with that. There are firms that can help you with that as well.
How much does one of these cost to get compliant? Ballpark.
These can depend on the size of the organization for sure, right? You can get something. I mean, I don't want to put numbers on it because I've seen pricing. It really depends on scoping, like how much you need looked at. If it's just going to be a document review and kind of helping to make sure you kind of have evidence that you meet security controls, that can be somewhat manageable. It really depends on what you need. And the mock assessment, industry is important, and there are companies that will probably give you pricing. I can't do it here, right? But I think it's important to kind of figure out what your options are, and I do think it's a good step if as you prepare.
Yeah, out of curiosity, do you guys as a law firm need to go through this if you're dealing with sensitive data for the government or government
We
cases?
go through different kinds of assessments for our clients, but because we're not a defense subcontractor, we're not subject. Law firms are not subject to regulations that are in contracts because we're not considered subcontractors, in my opinion. But there are different, certainly other standards you've got to meet. They're very important if you're a law firm, if you're a consultant, and so on.
Yeah, and if you're unable to get compliance, obviously you won't be able to bid on new work, but you have to like will your existing programs get canceled?
So, I mean, no, it's more of a forward-looking issue, right? So, if you have a requirement in a new, if it's added to your existing contract, then yeah, you've got an issue right away. If it's added via contract modification, through an option period. But usually we're going to see this coming up most often anyway in new RFPs. So it's going to really affect your ability to win a recompete, right? Or a new award. If there's a requirement in place, and there's supposed to be this phase rollout, like I said, but it's not like set in stone. We're going to see third-party assessments required in the next year.
What man, what implementation challenges are have you seen that most often lead to these disputes between primes and subs?
Well, so the primes are going to be under a lot more pressure to make sure they can field a team, right? So that's going to be on them to make sure if you've got like a major production contract, you could have 100 suppliers on it, right? And so you're going to have to do a lot of diligence. And so we're already seeing the primes kind of reinvigorate their efforts to send supplier notices and alert their suppliers that they need to really make sure they're going to meet level two. And that's been going on really since DFARS. That's been going on since 2015, 2016 already. So if you're a supplier, you've been getting these letters every, 3 months, every 6 months from your big prime contractors. Maybe you could have ignored them, for the first 7 years, but now it's a much more serious situation. And so the subcontractors, if they want to keep doing business with the Department of Defense and with their prime contractors, they do need to make sure that they can meet the requirements. And some of the primes are more aggressive than others in terms of sending out questionnaires, trying to gather evidence for their files to make sure they're comfortable with the readiness of their supply chain. So subs may push back on that. It's a lot of paperwork and so forth. So that's sometimes the tension that I've seen.
Absolutely. What are some of the legal pitfalls companies tend to overlook in this process?
I think, certainly, there's something called the Cyber Department of Justice Cybersecurity Fraud Initiative that rolled out about 4 years ago. And there are a couple of situations where that could come up anywhere, really, that could also give rise to False Claims Act liability. One situation would be if you have a misleading, especially an intentionally misleading self-assessment score. So we've been required, companies have been required since 2021, roughly, to do a self-assessment of their cybersecurity and come up with a score and post it in a government database called SPERS, the Supplier Performance Risk System, SPERS. So there are some companies that have been accused of having an intentionally inflated score, and that's given rise to potential liability under the False Claims Act. And then there's another scenario, certainly, that's come up where companies have had unrealistic deadlines to close deficiencies in their plans of action and milestones. So, just really important to be accurate in your representations to the government and have a plan to close out your gaps.
No, absolutely. And what part of this whole process causes the biggest delays?
So, I think, for me, I mean, certainly you got to have the resources, right? You may have a plan and you may have an IT budget and something happens throughout the course of the year, right? It could be a cyber incident and all of a sudden everybody's focused on incident remediation and you don't have the money to address your plans of action and milestones. So, I mean, certainly it's not cheap to maintain a cybersecurity program. So that's one of the delays that companies just don't have the resources, right? And they haven't had the incentive, frankly, until CMMC became a final rule to do it because it was always a cost, right? But now it's really it's a cost, still a cost, but it's also a cost of doing business. And if you want to keep doing business with the Department of Defense, you've got to be ready.
Yeah, no, absolutely you do. And I mean, I've heard varying things from people that are going through this process or have gone through this process. And obviously lining the assessors up and everything is crazy, and there's not a lot of them. And I mean, it's just expensive from what I understand. All parts of it.
Yeah, I mean, it's not intended to be cheap, right? It's if you want it, if you want to do business with the Department of Defense and handle controlled and classified information, you've got to make some investments. Now, there are workarounds, right? So if you're a small company and you can't, for whatever reason, maybe you don't have the resources, you can't implement 110 security requirements, right? In the near term, like maybe you could do it in 5 years or 3 years, but not right away. You're much more focused on staying in business, right? You got to win awards, you got to spend money on BD and developing capabilities and all of that, right? You could, I would say, it'd be wise to go talk to your primes, talk to your customers. If you're a subcontractor, it's a prime contractor, and see if that if your primes can give you access to their network that may be compliant, right? And so there are definitely workarounds like that that I would recommend. Again, not giving legal advice, just giving practical advice, thinking about that way in advance, right? And trying to figure out solutions before you have a requirement in an RFP or something that's slowed down to you and you don't have enough time.
Yeah, so you could potentially hold all your classified information in a partner's network who already is compliant and do your work in there.
That's something that that's an option, right? So then the controls on classified information is not on your network; it's on a network that's being managed by the prime, right? That's one certainly, one way to do that, right? So you just access it through a VDI or another means, and you can get around that compliance issue if the information doesn't hit your information system.
Oh, okay. All right. I feel like nobody's talking about that right now.
I think it's something that you want to have a dialogue, right? You want to have a dialogue with your customers about that. See if that's an option.
Yeah. Where's the line between a remediation plan and a compliance failure?
Well, timing's everything, right? So if you have a temporary deficiency, even if you have 110 security controls met, CMMC level 2, that's still okay as long as it's temporary, right? That's normal in the life cycle of an IT system, right? So, you need to push out a software update. There's some new configuration change on your system, and you're temporarily not able to meet a control. That's okay. But the issue that people have is like when a temporary deficiency becomes like a permanent one, right? Where basically if you were to ignore, hypothetically, if a company were to ignore the deficiency and never have a plan to close it, and that's where you get into trouble.
Right, where you don't actually work on closing it, you just ignore it. Okay, makes sense. And for small businesses, who are starting this process from scratch, what practical resources, and where how would you advise them to start? Like, what practical resources are there out there? What is this process look like? And especially focusing for smaller businesses.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely a lot of content. Like, I've written a bunch of articles and things like that. But what I would say is, in terms of like resources that you can leverage that are sort of blessed by the government, you could look at the Department of Defense Project Spectrum for some resources. The National Security Agency also has some free cybersecurity services available to DIB companies, defense industrial-based companies. And you can also look at the NDISAC, National Defense Information Sharing Analysis Center. They also have some resources as well. Those are three places where you can look for, for if you're trying to get started for the first time, kind of give you some guidance.
Okay, absolutely. And what's the big what's the major piece of advice you would give contractors to avoid future CMMC conflict?
Yeah, I think it's really important to take it seriously now that we have, final rules and they're in the regulations, right? You can look them up. They're in the regulations. So, time for delay is over. And then once you get CMMC level 2 or whatever, or maybe you're a level 1 company. I didn't talk about level 1, but if you only handle federal contract information, you're only required to meet basically 15 requirements of the 110. In that situation, then you can self-assess those 15 or 17, depending how you count them. And that's a lower threshold, right? But you still have to be able to meet those requirements if you're not handling controlled and classified information. But so you just got to basically figure out what your requirement is and meet it, and then you have to maintain that.
Yeah, are there only two levels? Is it just level one, level two, or is there a level three also?
There's a level 3, but that's not live yet. So we're going to see there's some additional enhanced security controls that would need to get met for level 3. That would happen, that would apply mostly to sort of critical technology sensitive. The most sensitive defense programs. But right now, I think the rollout we're going to see is level 1 and 2 in the near term. But companies are getting ready for level 3 as they need to if they expect to have those kinds of contracts.
Is there a time on level three? Or not yet?
So I know that there's been discussions within the department about relative level three. I don't know exactly where they are. They did, I believe they did some sort of a tabletop in the last, few months, with some defense contractors to try to scope out level three. But that's kind of, the current status is it's like the focus really is on level one and two right now, but we'll see level three and we'll see, more cybersecurity requirements come down in the future when the next revision of NIST 800-171 impacts the defense contracts.
Absolutely. So just out of, your personal opinion, I know that there's always a big push to, work with commercial companies and expand the contractor pool overall, within the DO, within government and within DoD specifically, to bring in new innovative technologies and bring in new perspectives. Do you think that putting, and obviously understanding the major need for cybersecurity and securing information, that's super important. Do you think that putting additional red tape up in front of, people doing business with the government is helping that or hurting that?
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting because if you look at everything else the administration has done, it's been to cut red tape. And there's something called a revolutionary FAR overhaul where, where basically the drafters of the regulations or the people that control the federal website and regulations are taking stuff out and trying to simplify acquisition. And this is in contrast to adding new regulations, right? So it's different, and it is. It's overdue in a lot of ways. But I think companies should not hesitate to do business with the Department of Defense and Department of War because of these requirements. They should just understand them and learn them and realize that it's part of doing business going forward with the Department of Defense.
Yeah, no, I just wonder how many small businesses are just going to say, I'm just going to focus on the commercial sector where I don't have this kind of regulation around me,
Yeah.
versus being wanting to go in with the government.
There's certainly gonna be some, right? If you're a dual use company and you've got a thriving commercial business, maybe you're gonna focus on that more, right? And you may not pursue opportunities in defense. But I do think though, what we're gonna see in the next 1 to 3 years are, kind of barriers being broken down. Other than these new cybersecurity regulations, we're gonna see barriers being broken down to simplify buying for the Department of Defense, Department of War, and we're going to see the Department of Defense and War act with speed more so than ever before. So there's going to be a ton of opportunities for companies that are willing to kind of navigate these regulations.
Yeah, no, man, that really is really interesting. What do you think about the FAR overhaul that just went live?
So I went to a conference last week, and one of the people that was involved in the FAR overhaul said, "Yeah, we," and hopefully I'm getting this right. He said there were 9,000 must or shall statements in the FAR, which is, the basically the book that applies to procurement contracts with the federal government. So 9,000. Guess how many they got them down to?
How many?
7,000.
Wow.
So we only have 7,000 now, right? So it kind of
That's
illustrates, like, okay.
not a huge decrease though, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the point, right? So like there's still so much that we have to do, right, if we're the government when we buy from contractors. So there's other transaction agreements, which is a way for the Department of Defense and other agencies to get around these federal acquisition regulations. We'll see much more use of that. We already are seeing that. So I think that's there's gonna be more opportunities. But yeah, I think we spent 40 plus years getting to the point where we had 9,000 shall and must statements. So it's going to take more than a minute to get it down and to streamline. And there's laws that maybe need to be changed and so forth. So it's not going to be easy.
Yeah, I mean, changing laws does not seem to be easy when the government can't keep itself open at this point. But hey, again, what am I, I'm just gonna run my mouth about these things though, Sandeep. You know what I mean?
I hear you. I mean, well, I know you follow this very, very closely and you do a lot of thought leadership in this space. So I'm kind of curious. I'll ask you a question then. Like, what do you see? How does 2026 look for you in terms of government contracting?
I mean, it's gonna, I think that there's been a lot of turmoil created within the industry this year, within the government as well. I think that there's going to be the rubber's going to hit the meet the road at some point, and there's just things that need to happen and need to continue to get done, right? Like you look at the FAA looking at a major overhaul of air traffic control system. That's a huge one, right? You look at the desire to bring industries like rare mineral mining back into this country again. That's something that I think the government's going to have to be involved in to help push that. Some of the things that I'm personally concerned about are like the de-emphasis on like on R&D money, on R&D expenditures. I think that when you look at studies, every dollar that the government puts into R&D generates over like $2.50 in economic activity. And those are things I think we should do. We should be looking at. I think that the industry in and of itself is going to continue to be fine because there's going to be a lot of stuff that needs to continue to happen. I think that the small business space at the federal level is really, I'm not going to say under attack, but when you look at the small business goals for all these agencies, they've been cut drastically in the last couple in the last year. And so, I think that I'm optimistic about it because I think there's going to be a lot of, there's just a lot of stuff that needs to happen still, no matter what. But I'm also continuing to look at state and local work as well as an additional option. And I'm moving the whole business into more into areas that you just have to. You just have to spend money on, right? I think that critical infrastructure is, there's a huge gap there. I think that our infrastructure is aging in a lot of places. And I mean, like the power grid is 50 to 70 years old in a lot of places, and we need to spend a couple trillion dollars on it to modernize it so that we can meet the increasing power demands associated with things like AI and data centers because, like the amount of electricity that a data center, that like a large data center that is running, AI programs in it, the amount of power it uses is equivalent to a mid-sized city, right? And so I think that it's going to continue. There's going to continue to be a lot of, there's going to be a lot of opportunity within the space. It's just going to depend on the direction that the government wants to go in a lot of ways. I also think that, some of the folks that are in the administration as appointees are very, very talented. I think that there's some of them are very talented and very experienced within the government. I think that some of them are not, right? And when you look at folks coming in from industry that don't have experience working within the federal space, that changes how you have to interact with them and interact with the government. And instead of asking them what they're trying to do, you have to come bring them problems and bring them solutions at the same time. So, I think it's gonna be good. I think it's gonna be a good year though next year.
I think I agree with everything you said. I think there will be a lot of growth in the government contracting space if the shocks to the system between DOGE and the shutdown are over, and if we're in business on February 1st or January 31st, I suppose, in 2026. I
Because
think
that
there's more.
the just to cut you off, the bill that was passed to reopen the government only reopens it through January 30th.
Right. So I know there's 31 days in January. So.
January 30th is a Friday, so that's why.
Yeah. So, okay, so I'll switch to Groundhog Day, right? Are we going to be have a Groundhog Day shutdown or not, right? I think that's the question, and I think hopefully nobody wants that, right? Nobody wants to have another shutdown. If we have a predictable year, companies, whether they're big companies, tech startups, small businesses, are going to be incentivized to invest and innovate. And if we have continued chaos, that's not going to happen, right? So we're really hoping, really, for everyone. And I live in the Washington, D.C. area, and we've been hit pretty hard by a lot of this. And I'm hoping that common sense prevails and we have a really big 2026. And the pent-up demand for government contracting services is there, right? A lot of people from the government left, right? So some of those talented, experienced people left in the last year. Work's got to get done, right? Problems got to get solved. So I think you're absolutely right to focus on the areas where it's sort of must spend and must solve for the government. And I do think that, with the benefit of a year in office, a lot of these political appointees will have understood better, like what their agencies are supposed to do, and will go out and execute.
Yeah, my problem, the inherent problem I have with the FORC program, the early retirement program that was being offered by the government this year, is that the only people that are going to take it are the ones that can get jobs in the private sector, which means that you're losing a lot of institutional memory and a lot of very, very talented people who are were in the government because they're the ones that can, the ones that can't get them, that cannot be employed in the private sector or don't want to be in a job where they can get fired very easily are the ones that are going to stay. And so, we'll see. But we all know like spending has gone up since January, January 20th or whatever, and it's going to continue to, I mean, it's going to continue to be here. And without like getting into policy decisions, I'm just hoping that we can, continue to take care of the workforce that does a lot of work behind the scenes that makes this country go that people don't even understand.
Yeah, I will say a positive thing for like the remaining government workforce is there's still some great people there, and there's some young people that need training, right? And so, I think they probably need some outside help from contractors, and that's okay. And for the folks that were able to, they like there's the old Yogi Berra line: if you come to the fork of the road, fork in the road, you take it, right? And people took it, and some people took it, right? They went one way and are in the private sector, and that's great for them. But I do think we have so many talented people still in the government, and they're overworked and underappreciated. And let's all give them some support, right? By spending on government contractors.
Yeah, well, we'll see if we're open in February. Who knows, Sandy? What's your prediction, man? No pressure.
Now, my predictions are often wrong, so I don't want to make a prediction on it, but I'm cautiously optimistic that in February that we'll have some sort of a longer term deal that'll get us through the 2026 election. But I don't follow it closely enough to know. But I that's my expectations that like there's no. The incentive to kind of drag it out forever is not there for either political party, but what do I know?
I mean, I just think that if the federal employees aren't getting paid, Congress shouldn't be getting paid either. So maybe that would help. But what do I know? I just I have opinions about a lot of stuff. And I think that people at the top should have to deal with the consequences that they're forcing on the folks that are having to go to work for 45 days and not getting paid. So.
I'm glad they're getting back pay because not all the contracts are getting back pay, right? So, at least the government folks are getting paid.
Yep, absolutely, man. Before we wrap up today, Sandeep, anything else you'd like to add about this very exciting topic around CMMC compliance?
Now, it's a really a fun day. I've been watching it for a long time, and it's great to come on your podcast and have a conversation about it. Again, this is going to be with us for a long time. And I hope that again the red tape doesn't hurt us in the robotic side, right? We want to have a system that works for everyone, but we got to make sure we secure the sensitive information that we have.
Completely agree, Sandeep. Really appreciate you coming on the podcast today. And everybody, thanks so much for listening. I hope you're having a great day.